Hello and welcome to The Wire Weekly, with the best stories of the week from the daily episodes of The Wire. I'm Amina Shakur, coming to you from Sin in Melbourne, Victoria. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Walkley Foundation. And today on the show...
One of the possibilities is that there could be a spill motion and at a special meeting on Friday.
Angus Taylor resigned as Shadow Defence Minister.
We worked with the government on donations reform.
The latest polling shows that South Australian Greens holding steady at 12% support. And later today...
is that they are struggling to find workers who have those specific qualifications that they're looking for.
Report warns of decline in arts education in Australia. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Angus Taylor resigned as Shadow Defence Minister, positioning himself to contest the federal Liberal leadership. With news polls showing the coalition supported by fewer than one in five voters, leader Susan Lee faces growing pressure. Although she has mended ties with the Nationals after their brief split, her leadership remains fragile. Press gallery veteran Mark Kenny discussed Lee's support with Stephen Hill.
It's going to be very difficult. The blood is in the water, if I can use an overly graphic analogy. My experience with these things is when instability, backgrounding, public commentary and the overall atmosphere of intrigue in Canberra reaches the levels that it has reached now, there's usually no going back. Now, that doesn't mean that Susan Lee can't win a party room ballot, and it may well be that she still narrowly has the numbers in her party room, but it seems like some sort of challenge from Angus Taylor is imminent.
Seen Angus Taylor organising some of his key lieutenants for this possible leadership challenge. What can we expect Angus Taylor to do?
I think this is going to come to a head in the next few days of parliamentary sittings. One of the possibilities is that there could be a spill motion and at a special meeting on Friday, but others are speculating that it might even be before that. If Susan Lee has survived this week, then she's probably going to survive for some period longer. If there were to be a spill motion at a meeting and she were to survive handsomely, that would put to bed any challenge in the short term. But at the moment, what it looks like happening is pressure is mounting behind the idea of a challenge from the right of the party behind Angus Taylor. Taylor himself has not been saying much, and his position is quickly becoming untenable in the shadow cabinet. And if you're about to challenge the leader, then by definition, you don't support the leader. It's not tenable for a person in that situation to remain in the shadow cabinet. I think in the next 24 hours, we're expecting to see Angus Taylor resign his position as Shadow Minister for Defence. That would clear the way for him to then challenge. But of course, he will need the support of a number of others in the party room, including a number of others in the shadow cabinet. So we may see then a cascade of other senior shadow cabinet ministers also resigning their positions in order to declare support for Angus Taylor. And then it's really a counting game as to how things proceed. One of the tricks that has been used in the past by leaders under siege, Malcolm Turnbull did this, is to put conditions on how a spill meeting could occur. And one of those conditions might be to require the challenging side, that is the right of the party, to produce a list of signatures that constitutes more than half of the party room. That would be 26 or 27 signatures, at which point that Susan Lee's leadership would be over by virtue of the spill motion itself. We have to ask the question, why is Taylor going slow? Well, we probably conclude that means that either he doesn't have the numbers, he's not sure that he has the numbers, or if he does have the numbers, that it's so close that it could be vulnerable, or it could be a very narrow win if he was to have it. You know, all of these things enter into the equation. But I suspect at the moment, Taylor's numbers are unreliable. If he's confident that he's got the numbers and he can get those signatures together, if that's the demand and he agrees to that demand, then I guess it can all proceed. But one of the criticisms of that approach of requiring signatures is that it's sort of meant to be a secret ballot, the leadership. And if you have a requirement that you have to get signatures on a piece of paper indicating non-support for the leader, effectively, by virtue of wanting a spill motion, then you're really asking people to declare their positions. That would mean a number of people in the shadow cabinet, in the outer cabinet, would have to declare their position even ahead of a meeting that might not happen. You might think, well, why would I put my name on that? There might not be sufficient votes in the end to force the meeting, and all I've done is declared my position, my opposition to the leaders. You can see that it's a pretty scary prospect for a number of people who are wondering how their party got them into this mess and what's going to be the resolution.
That was Press Gallery veteran Mark Kenny speaking to 2SER's Stephen Hill. The latest polling indicates South Australian Greens maintain 12% support, with the party positioning themselves as holding Labor to account. With at least 7 new candidates running this year, including Melanie Selwood, the Greens' lead candidate for the Legislative Council, the party continued to activate for social housing, 50-cent public transport, reaching net zero targets, and improving the state's algae bloom crisis. Radio Adelaide's Emma Watsky spoke with leader of South Australian Greens, Robert Sims, MLC, for more.
I'm really proud of what the Greens have achieved in the South Australian Parliament over the last 4 years. I mean, we've been in a situation where we've shared the balance of power with other independent and crossbench players, yet we've been able to deliver a lot. We were able to work with the Labor government to deliver the biggest changes to residential tenancies laws in 25 years, finally acts no cause evictions. We worked with the government on donations reform to finally ban political donations in South Australia. We were also able to get legislation passed, a private members bill to strengthen the penalties for demolition by neglect. I also got legislation through to protect and strengthen our public assets to ensure that they're not privatised without appropriate parliamentary scrutiny. We've also initiated a range of parliamentary inquiries on important issues like the algal bloom.
You've got 2 candidates running for the Legislative Council. How are you supporting them and strengthening your role in ensuring that Labor remains on track?
My role at the moment, because I'm not up for election myself, I'm halfway into an 8-year term, is really to support the candidates and get out there and do as much work as I can in terms of being out on the ground supporting them and also doing policy announcements and being out there talking about our agenda for the campaign, whether it's pushing for rent capping or building more housing or 50-cent public transport fares or things like more of a focus on our environment and tackling climate change. I'm trying to also push the 2 major parties to do better, which I think South Australians deserve.
What have been some of the community responses in different electorates that you've heard so far?
There's obviously a lot of concern around cost of living, and that's impacting on lots of people. The other thing that's coming up quite a lot is people are concerned about the potential for the Labor Party to win control of both houses of parliament and to have unfettered power. And I think people are really looking for a party that can be a handbrake on the Labor government and really hold them to account. As I mentioned earlier, the Greens have got a really good track record in terms of doing that.
And when it comes to supporting the needs of minority groups in the state, can you talk through perhaps some of the significance of your policies in relation to housing and also healthcare, because that's a really big concern at the moment?
I mean, in terms of minorities in particular, one of the things that we're really passionate about in the Greens is ensuring that women's reproductive rights are protected and that women are able to make decisions about their own bodies. We're also supportive of ensuring that trans people are able to access gender-affirming care and that those things are free from political interference, which I think is really important. And obviously those things are going to become a bit of a focus during this election with the policies of One Nation. In terms of the housing space, we believe that everybody has a right to a roof over their head and a place to call home. And that's why we've been pushing for an investment in a public builder. And we'd like to see a housing trust restore its mission as a public builder. So actually building properties for South Australians, 20,000 public homes over the next 4 years. And then also to address the issues we have within the rental market, a cap on rent increases, ensuring they can only increase once in a 2-year period in line with inflation. And we also want to address some of the issues we have around long-term vacant property.
Given the current state of the crisis, how much of an impact do you think an extra 20,000 social homes would have compared to, I think, Labor's proposed 1,000?
I think that the big difference is that the Labor Party is talking about very small-scale public housing investment. We're talking about large-scale public housing investment. And I think that would have a huge impact. I mean, it would certainly clear the public housing wait list. And if you had that huge investment in housing, really turbocharging a construction of housing over a four-year period, and you coupled that with rent caps and some controls over the amount of profit that landlords can make, I think that would be a real game changer for South Australia.
That was leader of South Australia's Greens, Robert Sims, MLC, speaking to Radio Adelaide's Emma Watsky. At the end of January, Australia recognised outstanding members of the community for their contribution to different community sectors. Eliza Hull received a Medal of Order of Australia for raising awareness and providing space for Australians with a disability in the music and media sectors. Ms. Hull offers workshops and is a part of Powered Media, an outlet providing a safe space for Australians with a disability to tell their stories their way. 4EB's Eduardo Jordan spoke with Eliza Hull.
Yeah, excited. When I first got the phone call, I actually couldn't believe it, but it feels like a real honour to, I guess, be celebrated for all the work that I've done over the years.
So you mentioning that you have been involved with Power Media lately. For our listeners who are unfamiliar, what's Powered and its aim?
Yeah, so Powered Media is, a media organisation. We're part of Disability Media Australia, as well as Community Broadcasting Association Australia. And we are an organisation that creates media for and by people with disability. So that can look like all different things from articles to podcasts to video. And I guess we share the stories that matter to the disability community and also give people opportunity to share their stories if they have a disability.
So what motivated you to be part of Power Media, and so far how's the platform going?
I have a disability myself. I have a condition called Charcot-Marie-Tooth, which I've had since I was 5 years old, but it hasn't really been in the last 10 years that I have been doing a lot of advocacy in disability. So that looks like all different things from advocating within arts organisations for better access for people with disability to creating children's books, Come Over to My House and The World We Can Build, about disability for young families and children, and also creating a book called We've Got This on parenting with disability. Powered Media is, I guess, an extension of the work that I have done in the past in media and in advocacy. And, is a media platform that I truly believe in because it gives opportunity to people with disability to share stories that matter, but also is a place that people with disability can go to and rely on to acquire information that is about our lives, and there really isn't enough platforms that does that.
And also, one of the journalists there working for Power Media is Emma Myers, who's done an incredible job lately. So that's a great opportunity to showcase people with disabilities.
Yeah, Emma Myers is fantastic. She's our journalist that's based at Parliament House. She has a disability, and she's just incredible at getting interviews with politicians and leaders of Parliament House and sharing the news stories that really matter to the community.
So you mentioned before as well that you're a musician, and you're also raising conversations across representation of Australians with disabilities in the media and the music. Why is this so important for these sectors to be well represented in disability?
Well, we make up 20% of the population, disability, and we statistically are twice as likely to create art. And I think that's because we have, big stories to share, and we like to express ourselves. But often arts industries, writing industries, media is often not accessible and inclusive for people with disability. And that can look like all sorts of things, from buildings not being accessible to technology and not being accessible, but also just that lack of representation. So for me growing up, I rarely saw anyone that had a disability in the books that I read as a child, TV, films that I saw. So I guess for me, I'm really passionate about changing that because we deserve to have our stories out there. And I often think about young people coming forward and how important that is to see people that look like them and to see that, we are different by having a disability, but that actually makes us, in my opinion, beautiful, and you know, diversity is what makes the world wonderful. So I'm really proud of being part of that movement.
Fantastic. Well done, Eliza. Now, finally, what would you like to say to our listeners with disabilities about being heard and well represented?
I guess for me, like I, you know, often just say, just, you know, believe in yourself. Your story matters. And we, you know, we hope to hear your stories, because we, for too long, that stories like ours have been underrepresented. And so for me, it's just like, don't give up and share your stories, be yourself.
That was OAM recipient Eliza Hull speaking to 4EB's Eduardo Jordan. Frontline organisations responding to Australia's housing crisis say they're at breaking point as demand for help continues to surge. A new survey from National Campaign Everybody's Home finds 9 in 10 housing services have seen demand rise over the past year, with many forced to turn vulnerable people away. The report also warns a growing staff burnout and housing insecurity among workers themselves is threatening the sector's ability to support those at risk of homelessness. For Triple Z's Mary Kate Hannigan spoke with May Azize, spokesperson from Everybody's Home, for more.
So we spoke to over 70 frontline service organisations around the country, including mostly housing and homelessness organisations. So the largest number of people who responded were from homelessness organisations. That's more than 70%. But we also had housing services, so they might be community housing providers, for example. And there were also quite a few people in the survey who were providing support to women escaping unsafe relationships, so domestic and family violence.
And what is the survey telling us about the scale of pressure that these frontline services are under right now?
Well, it tells us that the crisis has really been normalised. So when we first started this survey a couple of years ago, people, of course, were telling us that there was a crisis and that they were under pressure. Today, they're telling us that they're at breaking point, that they've been operating that way for years now, and that the impact of that over many years is really starting to hurt them, starting to affect their day-to-day operations. A lot of people told us that they were burnt out. Over 70% told us that they've got a lot of staff burnout in their teams. And 1 in 3 people actually told us that they were thinking of leaving the sector altogether because they were under so much stress.
Surveys found nearly half of the services say that the housing crisis is threatening their ability to operate at all. What does this look like on the ground?
Well, on the ground, it's a huge disaster, because we already know that these services are turning away 1 in 3 people who come to them for help. So government records show that about 1 in 3 people who come to one of these services for help gets turned away. And if that number is getting higher, it means more and more people potentially sleeping rough on the street, returning to dangerous and unsafe relationships. We actually have no way of knowing what happens to people after they get turned away. If they can't get help with groceries or bills, for example, if they're going to an emergency relief agency, if they can't get crisis accommodation that night, we have no way of knowing what happens to them. And there's just going to be more and more people like that who fall through the cracks.
And like you said, there's organisations turning people away. Who is missing out on support right now, or who are the most critical groups that aren't getting the support that they need?
Well, right now it's basically first come, first serve, and because these services are so tight, it's basically a whole lot of people who are getting turned away. People who are in the most immediate danger might be kind of triaged if they're going to get help first. But we know, for example, that there are thousands of women every year who return to violent and unsafe relationships, so we know that there's not enough space for them. We know that a lot of young people get turned away. All sorts of people are getting turned away, and again, because the system is just so overstretched and there are so many people getting turned away, people in all sorts of categories are missing out.
The strain on the sector, what's the differentiation between rising demand versus more complex cases?
The biggest contributor is that people can't afford a place to live. So that worsens everything. That worsens the complexity of cases. It worsens everything. So that is the biggest contributor. And when people told us, when we asked people what's the biggest contributor to rising demand, they told us that it was the sheer unaffordability of the rental market. So that is the number one contributor.
More public and community housing. Why is that the top priority?
The biggest problem that people tell us, and the biggest source of stress and anxiety for them, is that even if they can help, even if it's one of the, you know, the two in three people who comes to a service and actually can get help, say they can get crisis accommodation for a couple of nights, say they can get some help with groceries or paying a bill, at the end of the day, what you're doing is you're sending people back out into a rental market that they can't afford. You're sending them back out into the world that pushed them into needing help in the first place. We've got housing waiting lists that are over 10 years long, social housing wait lists that are over 10 years long. We've got 640,000 households right around the country who need social housing. So that's an enormous backlog, and the government's got no plan to take that on.
Maybe it's looking from a budget or resourcing standpoint, but what's the single most urgent action that the government can take?
What people have told us, and they've been really clear in this survey, over 85% of people told us that what they want to see the government do in the next budget is really make a plan to invest in social housing. So start with a really big boost to social housing and keep that up for years and years and years.
That was May Aziza, spokesperson for Everybody's Home, speaking to 4ZZZ's Mary Kate Hannigan. Is Australia at risk of becoming an artless nation? An advocate for arts education says it's time to act and refocus on nurturing creative skills. Chair of National Advocates for Arts Education, John Saunders, has co-authored a new report which examines the decline in tertiary creative arts courses, as well as a fall in enrolment in the some senior secondary school arts subjects. The Wire's Shannon Kirkwood with the story.
At a tertiary level, the data is showing us that there are fewer creative arts courses available, so that over the past 5 or 6 years, we have seen a decline in the number of courses that have been offered, particularly in when there's only one provider in a particular geographic area. So regional areas or outer metropolitan areas have been really impacted by that. And what we've also seen is that there are fewer students enrolling in those creative arts degrees at a tertiary level as well. So really, we saw a peak sort of in 2020, 2021. And part of that was to do with, COVID and lockdowns and people turning to study as well. But when we saw the former Commonwealth government led under Morrison introduce the JobReady graduate scheme, we saw that that's actually had a very big impact on the student contribution to those creative arts degrees. And so we have actually seen a really significant decline in enrolments since that policy has been introduced.
And so what are you seeing, or you personally witnessing, or what you've heard about the potential flow-on effects of fewer enrolments and creative arts courses just simply winding up?
Certainly what we're seeing from and hearing from the creative arts industry and creative industries, and it's across all fields in theatre, film, the visual arts and gallery sector, is that they are struggling to find workers who have those specific qualifications that they're looking for. And often it's not the artists themselves, it's those other workers who work in the arts. So it might be people who work in galleries or in performing arts centres, it might be producers and technicians, and those sort of suite of skills that are developed through those broad creative arts degrees offered at universities, not necessarily the fine arts degrees, which are sort of geared towards training in a particular arts discipline for, you know, to really become an artist.
What would be the message to those individuals who are perhaps deterred from entering because of the cost and the lack of options when it comes to studying?
I'd say that the ABS data that we've sort of looked at is finding there's about 200,000 people who work in the arts area in Australia, and that's about four times more than work in coal mining. So sometimes we think about jobs and employment opportunities in the arts as being not there, and that, you know, we might do a degree and study and invest in a career in the arts, and then there actually aren't jobs there. But what the data is also showing us is that it is a growing sector, that we are seeing the contribution that the creative arts sector makes to GDP, for example, in Australia, is increasing. So it increased by 6.6% from 2022 to 2023. It represents 2.5% of GDP in Australia. It contributes, you know, nearly $70 billion a year to Australia's economy.
And so what are you hoping to see when it comes to policy settings to address this?
Yeah, it's a great question. And really we're seeing students being disincentivized at a state level and also at a Commonwealth level through policy levers. So at a Commonwealth level, the National Advocates for Arts Education and many other advocates and organizations in this space are calling for a national inquiry into arts education and training. We haven't really had one. And that would allow us to unpack and explore the issues that we're highlighting in the article that the data is sort of presenting to us about what are those key challenges and what are some possible solutions and policy levers that could be pulled at a Commonwealth level. One big part of that is the Job Ready Graduate Scheme, which saw the student contributions for those creative arts areas increase. It's even worse in the humanities area. So someone interested in studying museum curation and museum management or film, for example, is impacted even more than studying the performing and visual arts at university. We're also seeing at a Commonwealth level a focus on STEM, science, technology, engineering and maths. And this really came from a report that came out from the chief scientist about a decade ago, highlighting similar concerns, but for those areas. So there were fewer students studying science and maths in senior secondary schools and fewer students going on to study those areas at university.
That was Chair of National Advocates for Arts Education, John Saunders, speaking with The Wire's Shannon Kirkwood. And that's the end of today's show. Thanks so much for your company wherever you are in Australia. The Wire Weekly is a collaboration between community radio stations SYN in Melbourne, 2SER in Sydney, Radio 4EB in Brisbane, and contributors from all across the country, with the great support from the Walkley Foundation and Community Radio Network. We'll see you next time with the stories making headlines across your community and Indigenous radio. At the same time on your local station. Check out all of this week's stories at our website, thewire.org.au. And follow us on social media. Just search for The Wire Radio, all one word, on X or on Facebook and Instagram at The Wire Independent Current Affairs on Radio around Australia. The Wire Weekly acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, where the program has been produced. And we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present and emerging. Today, The Wire Weekly is brought to you by SYN in Melbourne, Victoria. I'm Amina Shakur. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time with many more stories on The Wire Weekly.